Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Maradona. Here's Alistair Campbell. Back to Maradona.
Welcome to the Humorology Podcast with me, Paul Barros, and my glittering lineup of guests from the worlds of business, sport and entertainment, who are here to share their wisdom and their use of humour with you. Humorology is the study of how humour can dramatically improve every aspect of your business and your life. Humorology puts the fun into business fundamentals, increases the value of your laughing stock, and puts a punchline back into your bottom line. Please remember to like, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. My guest on this edition of the Humorology Podcast is an award-winning legend in the world of sports commentary. Best known for his iconic voice, he has built a career as one of the most captivating commentators in English football history. Making a name for himself during the epic conclusion of the 1999 Champions League final, he went on to commentate on countless sporting events, from the World Cup to the Olympic Games. He has spent the majority of his career as a primary commentator for the Premier League, UNICEF's Soccer Aid match, the Champions League, and EA Sports' massively popular FIFA video game series. More recently, you can find his wildly entertaining commentary of everyday life on his social media channels and find your favourite football moments in his print series, Commentary Chart. It's an absolute treat to have his legendary voice grace the show. Clive Tilsley, welcome to the Humorology Podcast.
I mean, given this is a podcast about comedy, I'm not quite sure how seriously to take all of those compliments, really. Are they double-edged?
No, there's no double-edge in there at all, Clive. And one of the things is that I have a 22-year-old son called Sam. He turned 22 yesterday, in fact. And he never gets very excited. We have some huge names on this podcast. Your name came up. And he was suddenly excited because he grew up with you, what playing FIFA on. And so you are, and he was like, you know, oh no, he's a legend. He's an absolute legend. And he was going, cheers, Alan. You know, all your highlights were played to me by my son. So if I didn't know that this was important, it is now.
It's very gratifying to connect with somebody 22 years of age. I've got four big things, which I loosely call children, between the ages of 28 and, I don't know, 133. And, you know, whenever anybody suggests that we need 30-year-old commentators to commentate to 30-year-old listeners or viewers, my argument against that is that these four people are amongst my best friends on the planet, and I have to communicate with them. That's part of my parental responsibility. I want to communicate with them because I love and like them very much. I'm very proud of them all, and they kind of keep me current. You know, I have to listen to their music. I have to sample their content, which is forwarded to me on various platforms. And so, you know, it is really reassuring to me that somebody of the age of 22 I've never met in my life likes some of my work. I think that's really important.
He doesn't just like it, Clive. He loves it. He honestly, he said the word, you know, the way they are at that age, they don't bullshit, as they say. They tell it as it is. And he just said, he's a legend. There you go. Doesn't get better than that. And a current legend. And
well, can we wrap the show up there? That seems to me a fairly good conclusion. Thank you very much indeed for having me on. And goodbye, everybody.
all right. Well, we'll take it. Part two of the interview with Clive Tilsley is starting now. You grew up in Warrington in Cheshire, Clive. Was humour valued in your family?
I actually grew up in Bury, which is not a million miles away from Warrington, but is what people of my generation would call Lancashire. It's now Greater Manchester. But I mean, I think there's a loose, a very, very loose guide. The further north you go in our country, the more important down-to-earth humour becomes. I think a lot of the classic sitcoms were set in sort of northern settings. And I mean, some would argue that with rain falling on you every day in Bury, you've got to find something to laugh at. But I was very fortunate in so much that I was as intrigued by comedy as I was by music from a very early age. You know, I think a lot of our early heroes in life are sporting heroes, obviously, but they're the musicians, the bands, the songwriters that, you know, touch our teenage sensibilities. But I found several comedians in that part of my life who probably had as big an impact on me as the musicians that I was listening to. So I wanted to be funny. I was in a boarding house at school. And when you are living in a culture which is essentially governed by boys in this case, who are older than you are, you've got to listen to their music, you've got to listen to their humor. You run the risk of being alienated just by your age, unless you can engage with them in some way. And if they run you into a corner of any kind, you've either got to be able to fight your way out of it or talk your way out of it in a boarding house. I've never been in a fight in my entire life. So I talked my way out of the most difficult situations that I faced as a young person, and probably still do to this day.
You said you were in a boarding house, so you were at boarding school. And that is, you know, to a lot of people, quite harsh. Well, I mean, were you seven when you went there, or was it older?
No, 12. And it was a day school with a boarding house. So we were actually outnumbered 5-1 by the day boys, which in many ways probably gave us more of an identity than it would have done in a bigger all boarding school. You know, we were 50 kids from whatever it is, eight or nine different year groups. And so I say quite literally, you learn the deadly sins of teenage life a little quicker than you would have probably have done if you were just mixing with people of your own age. So, you know, I was a smoker and a drinker long before, and I should have been, or at least I toyed with those things much earlier than I should have done. And as I say, I listened to the music of boys 3, 4, 5 years older than myself. And therefore, inevitably, I was introduced to their humour. You know, Monty Python's Flying Circus, I probably got earlier in my sort of adolescence than I would have done if I hadn't have been around boys who were 3, 4, 5 years older than myself.
So was it important to the, if you like, social status at school, that to be able to remember? Because I remember at school, I probably, like you, very, very young, was remembering Monty Python lines, because, you know, our younger audience won't realise that you didn't have any recording. You had to have a good memory. And if you wanted to know the parrot sketch, you really had to practice it again and again in your head. Until the records came out, of course. But was it important to the social status at school that you could make people laugh? And when did you realise you had that gift?
I think I was almost a student of comedy in a sense. You know, the comedy I enjoy is what I would call wit, rather than jokes or slapstick of people. I don't laugh at people falling over. You know, clever is a double-edged word in humour, because you can be far too clever for your own good. And some of my commentaries down the years have suffered from precisely that. But cleverness in humour, in dreaming up surreal twists on ordinary life situations, is what Monty Python's Flying Circus was all about. And that's why it grabbed it. And that's why every edition of the program, the weekly edition of the program, became a communal event in a boarding house or later at university. And it was that kind of, I suppose you'd call it, observational comedy. You know, the people I find funniest are brighter than me. They're cleverer than me. You know, Billy Connolly, Stephen Fry, Dara O'Brien. And my laughter is a kind of a round of applause for their comedic intellect, you know, the imagination in their intelligence, that kind of mental dexterity that you see when O'Brien comes on stage and spends most of his act just engaging with the people on the front row. I mean, what kind of an act is it where you've no idea where you're going every night, but you're able to hold your own? And that, as I say, cleverness in the very best sense of the word is very important. And I think probably in the environment in which I grew up, I had to learn to be clever.
Yeah, it's clever and brave, isn't it? Because it's kind of like putting yourself on the tightrope. I spent many years at the Comedy Store, and some of the bravest people I knew were the ones who went out to the Late Show, which started at midnight, and would go on and then improvise.
Yeah, and I think humour is... It's the very best form of human checks and balances. If someone or something is getting above themselves, getting ahead of themselves, getting too full of themselves, nothing cuts them down like a great put down. And that's why some of the dictatorial figures in the world have tried to censor or ban humor, not just despots and, you know, Trumpian leaders, but people that try to control the frontiers of humor by imposing their own kind of moral red lines. And the problem with all of that is you can't stop people laughing. Even if they do it in private behind your back, what makes us laugh tells us more about ourselves than virtually anything. Sometimes I don't like myself for finding something funny, and that actually prompts me to take a good look at myself and maybe address a prejudice or a preconception that I have about somebody or something. And as you say, comedy is cruel. It's invariably at somebody else's expense. You know, satire, irony are really powerful. They're extreme uses of the language, and they're usually to highlight some kind of extreme behavior. And when I was watching, I don't know, again, the danger is losing part of the audience, but I would actually urge people who have never watched Till Death Us Do Part to go and find it and watch it. It would never be aired today. It would seem to be totally inappropriate, and you would find it an uncomfortable watch. But set in its moment, it was actually full of social comments. It was full of challenges to us to take a look at ourselves and make sure we weren't that central character, Alf Garnett, ourselves. And that is the power of comedy. That's what really grabbed me about the cleverness of the writing and even Mitchell's performance as Alf Garnett, because he wasn't that kind of man. It was a totally fictional character. And there were checks and balances in the show, in so much that his daughter and son-in-law were always challenging him. And even though, say, the language you would find very uncomfortable today, it would actually be a really good snapshot of some of the issues of the late 1960s and early 1970s that I, as a young, impressionable person, grew up with.
No, it's very interesting because the writer, of course, was Johnny Spate. Mm. And Johnny was, funnily enough, as a young boy, I met Johnny Spate quite a few times because my best friend's father, when growing up, was William G. Stewart, who directed some of Johnny Spate's later works, like The Lady's a Tramp and things like that. And Johnny was always really angry that people couldn't see the satire. And he was always saying that actually Warren, or the character Alf Garnett, always got his comeuppance. And actually, Warren was a Jewish actor, you know, so there were all these levels where you could do it. But I was interested because in your excellent book, Not For Me, Clive, Stories from the Voice of Football, you have a quote, and I loved this quote. You said, "There are only so many things that I would march on Parliament in support of, but the defence of comedy is one of them. Laughing at something we don't think we should be laughing at is a revolutionary act, an involuntary act, as we just said earlier on. It tells so much about ourselves. Not only that, but it gives us a peep into how others see us. It's enlightening and it's also kind of healthy, as long as we find the answers," which is what you're talking to the questions we ask. Why do you feel so strongly about why humour is healthy? And do you think it actually helps to level the playing field?
I totally respect the need to protect the feelings of the outnumbered and the vulnerable. But cancelling is not the answer to that, not in my opinion anyway, any more than editing or rewriting pieces of popular content from the past is a solution or a valid solution in my opinion. I think that it... Speaking publicly comes with important responsibilities. And I think two particular responsibilities when you have the platform that I have and you have, and they're kind of linked. One, you've got to be careful not to impose your experience on others. I mean, I have strong opinions on politics and current affairs, but I can't speak from the point of view of anyone in poverty or disabled or gay or black or I mean, for that matter, anyone who's athletic or musically gifted or multilingual and a litany of things that I'd love to be. I have never been that person. I can't dictate what will offend or upset any section of my audience. And I therefore have got to listen and try to understand and respect someone that is uncomfortable with something that I've said. And I'm not even a comedian. In the social media age, we all get to speak in public. And so we should all try to accept those responsibilities. You know, empathy is a walk in the shoes of others. I don't mind political correctness at all because it is merely a sensitivity towards difference. And difference in life is great. But comedy is not empathetic. It's not sensitive. There is invariably a butt of the joke. There's an argument for saying, I think, that comedy should be free from the constraints of living a respectful, caring, responsible life, because comedy is cruel. It feeds off human failings and weaknesses. You shouldn't really be booking a comedian and then telling them, oh, no jokes about blondes or cyclists or vapors or whatever. We should be able to take or leave comedy like we do country and Western music or, I don't know, darts, you know, but because comedy is so powerful, it's become liable to censorship. And who decides what is good and bad for us in the UK in 2023? The Daily Mail. The keeper of the nation's morals and ethics is something like the Daily Mail. And that's why you end up with virtually no sitcoms anymore, because the sitcoms of the past that I grew up loving and were really an institutionalized part of my life, they're too dangerous. And that's why you end up with Miranda and Mrs. Brown's Boys now.
Well, it's very interesting. We had Jimmy Mulville, who I don't know if you know Jimmy, but he owns Hattrick, who make Have I Got News for You and other Derry Girls and all that. And we had this conversation. And by the way, he comes from the same standpoint. He said now if he puts a racist or somebody who is sexist in a sitcom to show them up for their racism or sexism, people, before they realize the arc of the story, will say, you can't have that person in there. And his point being, you have to have that there in order for them to be taken down a peg or two.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, funny is a personal thing. It's a matter of taste. And taste today is a dangerous place. I mean, some of the things that are funniest to me are some of the things that are closest to me, I guess. I mean, there's a younger comedian by the name of Daniel Sloss, who's originally from Scotland, who I find really interesting and I find funny. And I have to kind of hesitate before I say that I find him funny, because he does entire routines about the loss of his disabled sister who died. And you can't get more unfunny than that. But he's brilliant. And, you know, my late father was particularly unfunny in the last couple of years of his life. But when I think back on those last couple of years, when I look at the rose that I planted in the back garden, the red rose of Lancashire, and see him and his ashes beneath them, I think back of all that grief that he caused me, and actual comedy in some of the moments that we shared together in the last few difficult years of his life. And I think that's the only way you can look back on those things and come out of them with any kind of, I mean, context is probably dead in the modern world, but with any kind of context as to the effects and the lasting delights that his memories leave with me, you know?
Well, but again, that is using humour as a tool. And the whole Humorology project is about using it. It's using humanity, humility and humour and good humour to get a perspective on life, isn't it? And that's what keeps. But that's all it is perspective. And I went to a big comprehensive school where there were 2,100 boys, and it was a zoo. But comedy was the binding force between whatever race, whatever year, whatever person it was. That was still the bonding tool that you get. If you manage to make somebody laugh, surely there's no bigger bond between you at that point.
I remember the day that I, in a very ironic moment of role reversal, I took my dad's car keys off him. He was nearly 90. And I mean, he was like a scolded child, really, when I said, no more, Dad. The car's good. You've got to stop driving. I'll set up an account with a local taxi firm. And anywhere you want to go, it's all on me. It's no problem at all. And in order to try to appease him, I volunteered. And I lived like 30, 45 minutes away from him then. I volunteered to take him on his weekly shop to the supermarket, which, as with most things as you get on in years, becomes something of a ritual, something of a routine. You know exactly where you're going to go, what you're going to buy, who you're going to see, what time you're going to arrive and leave. And so I did all this to his timetable. And we arrived at the supermarket with his blue badge in my car, and he's directing me towards a parking spot. And as we approached it, I saw the sign for mother and babies. And I said, no, Dad, this is not your parking spot. This is for parent and child. And he said, park there. I said, no, there'll be some spaces for, you know, people with physical difficulties, disabled spaces, as they were once called. And he said, no, park there. So with a couple of cars behind me and me looking around, I parked in the spot. And as I'm getting out of the car, I point to him at the sign and the illustration of the mother and child. And I said, this is for parent and child. And this 90-year-old man looked across at his 60-year-old son. He said, well, what are we? Do you know what? You're right, Dad. That's exactly what we are. We're a parent and child. We're okay.
Oh, well, that's lovely, isn't it? But by the way, I'm my mother, who will be listening to this at some stage, is 91. And my mother still tells, when I go to her house and I say, I'll pop across the road to get you a paper, always says, mind the traffic. And I always think, I've been all over the world on my own and managed to survive. But this is the thing you have to tell me.
It's love. I got a call from the very same supermarket a few weeks earlier. And my dad's card had been refused, declined. And they wanted somebody to pay for the shopping that he was standing at now at checkout. And it turns out that there was a very, very helpful employee cashier there who he always tried to go to with his weekly shop. And he would hand her his credit card, followed by a piece of paper, which he had his PIN number scribbled. And this very responsible individual always checked him out, but always tried to encourage him not to do it this way, to remember his PIN code, because she shouldn't really know it. And he arrived the previous week and he said, it's OK, I now know what my PIN code is. So he hadn't had to handle over the piece of paper. And she had told him the previous week, well, what I want you to do now, Mr. Tilsley, is to change your PIN code. So just think of it. He says, is it your birthday? And he said, yeah, that's my PIN code. I said, well, think of something else. Think of your son's birthday, maybe, and make that the PIN code. OK. So next week he'd come up, and this is why I got the phone call, and he changed the PIN code. He put a brand new number into the PIN machine. But of course, he hadn't changed the PIN code. All he'd done was change the number in his head. So when he put it in three times, it was the wrong PIN code. I had to make the call to him. Now, that makes me laugh. But actually, it was his inability to deal with the 21st century that I was laughing at, that he didn't realize he just had to think of a new number in your head. And that would automatically work on the credit card. Maybe one day we will have credit cards like that. But we didn't have in whatever it was, 2019, when I got this particular phone call. Now, am I laughing at him or am I laughing with him? Because I think that is the key, really, to taste, if there is such a thing, good taste within humor. The moment you start to laugh at people, you're into dangerous ground. You know, I've been at the eye of maybe three or four Twitter storms in my long career. And they've usually been at times when I pushed it a little bit with a comment and it may be perceived that I was laughing at somebody rather than laughing with them. And I think that's quite a good, another good check and balance with our humor, be it you performing stand-up on stage or me working some humor into a commentary sitting alongside Ally McCoy, it's impossible not to, or just something that you might flippantly say in conversation. And I've been in company where the level of humor has made me uncomfortable. And it takes a lot of guts and maybe stupidity to actually say so. Maybe that you're uncomfortable with what the group of people, particularly their friends, they may be guys I play golf with, you know. And I am uncomfortable with what they're finding funny. Now, what do you do in that situation? Well, maybe you just say, are we laughing with this person or are we laughing at them? I think it's a good question to ask.
Yeah, or just go, it's not for me. You touched on the fact, and I occasionally ask guests on this podcast, have you ever crossed the line and gone too far? Because part of comedy is about finding the line. And so occasionally you will. And I was thinking about the infamous nun joke, which I think caused some controversy and led to you apologising on air. I didn't think the joke was that bad, actually.
I don't remember that.
Oh, you can't remember that one. It was during the Champions League between Man United and Bayer Leverkusen. You said, we're seeing more crosses than a pair of nuns in a cathedral.
No, I don't think I've ever said that. I think that's probably been somebody reporting that I said that.
Is that apocryphal?
I'm as certain as I can be that I would never say anything like that. I don't, it's just not my style that. I mean, I've made mistakes, but I don't think the nun line is mine. I got in trouble once for saying this may sound Irish, but because a team were two or three down at Old Trafford and they weren't trying to do anything other than keep the score down. And I think I may have said this may sound Irish, but you know, Bayer Leverkusen, actually, whoever it was, are playing now to lose this game by as few as they can. And somebody of Irish origins, they weren't actually born in Ireland, took me all the way to the highest level of viewer complaint, to the point where I had to appear in front of a committee and explain what I'd said. And this guy, who was very eloquent, had said that he was surprised that at a corner kick, I hadn't said there should be a Pakistani shop banner on it. And it was really, you know, expanding and exaggerating the nature of what I fairly innocently said, because it was quite a common phrase probably in the first part of my life. This may sound Irish, but I mean, we don't say it now, and that's cool. I'm all for progress in that sense. That's how we live and learn as a humanity. And if people are offended by that, then I totally understand it. We don't tell Irish jokes anymore, and nor should we. But this guy really, really laid into me, and I had to do a big, big apology in order to sort of creep out of the corner that he backed me into. I think it was excessive, but I was apologetic. I was apologetic for the initial comment, but I just needed to be made aware of it and how inappropriate it was, and I was never going to do it again. And I think, if I find my app mentions are full of one recurring thought about something I've said, whatever my initial instincts are, you've got to listen to your critics and you've got to pay them the respect of actually taking the trouble to register some level of complaint. I mean, Twitter isn't a canvassed opinion poll, but it is now a platform where people can get to you and can get to you with their views. And so, you know, in that instance, I was prepared. I was more than happy to say sorry. I just didn't particularly feel as if I should lose my job over that.
No, and but also, you know, a throwaway line from somebody of a certain generation. I don't think anything should be jumped upon. And by the way, I come from a background where when it originally started at the Comedy Store, it was called alternative comedy because it was no sexist, no racist stuff. But actually that evolved over time, whereby you could say things.
Everything evolves over time. You know, it's evidence that the world is turning. And I'm very aware of a 21st century where opinions seem to be becoming more and more polarized. And there's almost a demand. I don't know if it's a social media thing. Maybe the lack of human contact during COVID has exacerbated this, where we've now become more accustomed to communicating as we're communicating today. And, you know, we're going to get together and have a glass of wine or two at some stage in the future. But this is the most convenient way of communicating, but it's not that natural. It doesn't allow much room for nuance. And I think, you know, most of the world isn't white or black. It's a color somewhere in between. And that's where we live. You know, we do live in middle ground most of the time. And this determination of people with a cause to either get you to declare for it or be the infidel, I think is really, really dangerous. And it becomes particularly dangerous to public speakers and especially comedians.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Yeah, I think that's that the generation of the keyboard warrior who is looking for things to be offended by because it increases their status on Earth. I can show how good I am because I'm going to point this out to other people. And I think it's I think you used the most important word, which I think in comedy is nuance. And by the way, I could say something and frequently do that if you wrote it down is insulting, but because of the tone of my voice and the look on my face, you will know it's not offensive. Four eyes, you know.
Yeah, I mean, we're the keepers of our own sense of humor, aren't we? And if we don't find it funny, then nobody else is going to get it, that's for sure. I get a big kick out of making people laugh or smile. It's fulfilling. It's infectious. It can be seductive. My wife thinks I'm humorous. You know, it's central to our relationship, to our love. We laugh at the same things. And it's just the most lovely thing to see a smile on her face because of something that I've said. It is one of the best sensations in human experience, sharing a laugh with somebody or making them smile. But I think it's important to be able to laugh at yourself. You know, it was something that you mentioned to me when we set up this podcast. Yeah, it's crucial to the very existence of humor that you can laugh at yourself, because if you can't, then you kill the laugh for everybody else. And it's a really endearing quality, you know. Roy Keane can laugh at himself, does laugh at himself. And if Roy can do it, we all can. I mean, I like to have, you know, the last word in any conversation, even with my wife, maybe even with you. But if that last word is kind of self-effacing, if it's self-deprecating in some way, then I think it qualifies and tempers your view or your humor. And that's where you can introduce some nuance by not only, as you say, facial expressions, but, you know, I got into a fat shaming storm at a soccer aid. I apologize to the two people who were offended. Neither apology was acknowledged, so presumably they weren't actually accepted. I didn't actually use the word fat at any stage. And what I did say, one of the things that I said, was that he's on the same diet as me. Now, that doesn't make it inoffensive, what I said, because I'm overweight too. But it kind of qualifies it in so much there's a certain amount of sympathy and empathy and understanding, I think, if you are prepared to put yourself down a little bit in the process. And you know, I think the best comedians, I mean, Billy Connolly is a wonderful example of that. an absolutely heartwarming example of that. And the way he now deals with Parkinson's is by, in part, by laughing at the things he can no longer do in life. And it just makes him so lovable. And really, I think once he's brought you into his world in that way, then he's almost free to say whatever he likes, because you instinctively, whether you've ever met him or not, like and love Billy Connolly. So away you go, Billy, tell me.
One of my favourite clips recently, you talked about Roy Keane, what was he saying about that he's a baby? And then they start laughing, and then he's a baby. And he does it a third time, and they roar in the studio with laughter. And he sees it in himself, you can tell, and starts laughing at how seriously he takes himself.
Yeah, I mean, I think footballers are really interesting. There's an image of footballers that are, they're all thick, and not too many of them have got university degrees, but most of them have what I would call a street intelligence. You see it in the way they play, and you hear it in their banter. I mean, banter's a kind of a dirty word now. And I do think the dressing room culture is a harsh one, but it's the language of football. And actually, ex-players like Roy find some of the same vibe when they join a broadcast team and we all travel together and work together. I think we're becoming more and more aware of the dangers of communal banter, more sensitive to possible victims of it. But I think if I'm honest and if we're realistic, it's still a bit of a testing ground for the strength of a person's personality within a team group. Rightly or wrongly, you know, I love the crack, and I can usually look after myself in any exchanges. The question is whether there is somebody who is struggling to look after themselves in those circumstances. And humor can be a very dangerous thing to weaponize if it becomes a bit of a bullying tool. And as I say, I think footballers find out about each other a little bit by winding each other up. We see it actually out on the field. And I think in the 21st century, in a more diverse dressing room where there are players who may be struggling with the language and so on and so forth, you've got to be, you know, the manager and the captain have got to be mindful of the impact. But that, when a group of people are together in some kind of team situation, you may be just out having a bit of supper together, and somebody sets off and says, "Oh, what are you like? And what are you like?" That's when it really starts. The community, the communal sharing, bonding between us comes out in our ability to see the comedy in each other. That's often a test of real friendship, I think.
Well, that's so true, because I worked for many years in rugby. I used to do a show called School of Hard Knocks, which you may know on Sky. And I did it with Will Greenwood and Scott Quinnell. And they're quite big lads. I don't know if you've noticed. But
yeah, they all are.
Well, but they're like 6'6", and Scotty's built like a brick outhouse, as they used to say. When I first came into the show, they'd already been doing it a few months, and I'd come in, and we ended up doing it 9 years together. They tried to slay me immediately, you know, because that's to see, can you play? Can you take it? Are you a team player? Are you part of the team in rugby? That's what happens in a changing room in rugby, in football, everywhere, because it's, are you up to this? Because we want to play, and it's kind of like bringing people into the fold. And if you can take a joke, you are accepted into the community.
Yeah, but it is dangerous. And I think we've become more and more aware of that. You know, I talked at the start of this about the intellect, if you like, of the people that made me laugh, you know, the first people to make me laugh. And, you know, that I say that cleverness is a wonderful thing, as long as it isn't used against somebody. I mean, you would hate to have been in an argument with, I don't know, you know, Tony Hancock or Woody Allen, or yeah, I mean, because these guys, and we see, I mentioned Dara before, you know, they are so sharp. And if anybody starts to get a little bit too clever on the front row, these people can really look after themselves. And that's kind of what struck me about those early comedians that I listened to. There were a couple of radio shows. Adrian Just was the host of one of them that mixed music with comedy clips. And that's probably where I was first introduced to Hancock and certainly Woody Allen in his stand-up days, Bob Newhart, Joyce Grenfell, these incredibly brilliant, innovative comedians who could make us laugh by reciting one side of a two-way conversation. I don't know if they were the first to come up with that kind of comedy, but it absolutely struck me as being just brilliant and something that I wanted to aspire to. And I think I mentioned to you earlier that when I was at university, I wrote and acted in a comedy review, and we took it to Edinburgh 2 years. And one of the highlights of my stays in Edinburgh was to go to see the Cambridge Footlights of the day, because they were the trailblazers. And these were the people that I'd become entranced by, you know, by Peter Cook and John Bird and Eleanor Bron and Jonathan Miller and Alan Bennett. And then obviously the Python guys, Cleese, who is funny to me to this day. And I was in awe of these people. And it was, I mean, quite apart from a laughing experience, it was a learning experience. And just learning from their, well, to use the word again, their cleverness.
I think that's so right. And it's while you were talking about that, and I think it's fascinating, by the way, that I only found out today that you'd actually been in comedy, in a sense, with your university days.
Before and taking commentary. It up to,
yeah, no, but one of the things that makes you stand out as a brilliant commentator is the lightness, the ability to get humour out of a situation, because these are, you know, gladiatorial events that you're commentating on, but you manage to see the light side of it. And actually, true drama, which is what I think football is about the light and the shade and getting both sides into it.
I think in communication of any kind, you've got to know your audience. And really, probably my great mentor in the business, the late Reg Guttridge, used to drum into me, identify your audience and commentate to them. And he would argue that an England World Cup game to an audience of 25, 30 million people is almost a different sport to commentating on a, you know, Europa Conference League game, 5:30 on BT Sport to whatever, 30,000 people, because they're football nuts. When England are playing at a World Cup, then your Uncle Joe and Auntie Myra are watching their only football match of the year. They don't know the offside law. And Reg would say there's almost an argument for explaining the offside law at some stage. And so when you're trying to make people laugh, you really have got to go back to that responsibility that I talked about at the start. You know, I think humor is a great attention grabber. There's so much content out there now. What tweets do we forward to our friends? We send humorous tweets on. You know, rich humor is engaging, and engagement is the key to communication. But you've got to know your audience. I mean, I've heard Boris Johnson getting endless laughs at a Tory party conference with material that I haven't found the least bit funny, actually quite the bleeding opposite of funny. But if your humour works with your audience, you'll win their attention and affection. And I do a little bit of lecturing now at a university up in the Manchester area. It's essentially Gary Neville's university, UA92. And I put some content, or they put some content of me starting a lecture on preparing for a job interview online quite recently. And it kind of went viral. And I started the lecture by walking in on the phone, swearing, sounding like a real kind of Alan Sugar apprentice graduate, hard-assed, hard-headed. I ended the phone call, looked at the students, basically said, who are you? Oh, yeah, I know now. You're second years. No, we're third years. Oh, well, I don't read briefs. I'm far too important for that. In fact, I'm the only important person in this room because I'm the only person I've heard of. I've never heard of any of you, so you better listen to everything I'm going to say. And went on, and I'm staring into these open eyes and open mouths, thinking, what the fuck is coming in here? And then, of course, after 2 minutes, I stop. And I say, when you go into a job interview, the first 30 seconds are probably the most important 30 seconds. You need to make an immediate impression. I have just given you an illustration of how not to make a good impression in your first 2 minutes in the company of a room full of 150, 200 strangers. It might not have worked. You know, there's a moment when I'm looking into their eyes thinking, are you getting this or are you not? And how far can I take this before I have to come back down and say, just kidding, this is me now.
Yeah.
But it's attention grabbing. And if I just walked in and shuffled some papers and said, right, we're going to talk about job interviews, there would have been somebody snoring within 30 seconds. You've got to take that chance as a communicator in order to get attention. And as I say, humor is a wonderful tool like that.
I think that, and I just wondered, and earlier on I was thinking the analogy, and you talked about attention grabbing, and the ability to look after yourself, the comedic one of if anybody's heckling to our thing, and the football one of when you go on the pitch a la Roy Keane. And we are recording this on the day after the Arsenal lost 3-0. And what happened in the first 10 minutes of that match was defining, was it not?
Yeah. I mean, footballers will always tell you that, you know, if you start a game badly, I love my golf. You know, if I make a 4 at the first, I've got a chance. So I make a 7 at the first. I'm thinking, I'm only 450 yards from a bar here. I could just turn around and walk in. You know, this isn't going to be my day. And hardened professionals, athletes, are able to deal with setbacks far better than most of us. And I would think, yeah, stand-up comics have got to have that ability too, to, you know, ride the waves, ride the silences, you know, try to win over the audience. We've all been in an audience where either a public speaker or, and it can happen at a wedding, cracky, you know, where it's just not working, this.
And tumbleweed.
It's a long way down from where you are once you get stuck on a ledge with no material that's working here.
But it's funny enough, we just had Alistair Campbell on the show for a second time, and he's, as you know, a huge football fan, that we were talking about. He'd made up a word in his new book called Perseverance. And I said my favourite word was the Ian Dowie bounce back ability, which was, and but some people have that ability. And isn't that the thing that makes the difference? I mean, this is essentially a business podcast about humour, but doesn't humour give you that bounce back ability whereby you can maybe laugh at yourself, not take yourself too seriously, and then perhaps turn the audience round?
Yeah, I think probably the biggest lesson, if that's what we're trying to offer, is to research and know your audience. I host corporate events of one kind or another, and I treat them like a football commentary. And you talked about my commentary charts at the start, which are the handwritten charts that I prepare with all the information that is there. Some people sort of say it's to fill the quiet spots. No, it's not. Some people say it's a safety net. Well, to a degree, it's a safety net, yeah. But I think of it more as a comfort blanket. I think of it when I look down at my notes just before Mark Pugach or whoever hands to me, I'm thinking to myself, I've done my prep. I know more about the backdrop to this game than anybody listening or watching. I've given myself a chance of getting this right. And I think if you go into an industry awards event, and you know something about that industry, you know something about the people in the room and what they do and how they interact, then that you owe, particularly if you're being paid, you owe it to them to do that basic research and get to know your audience. And if you can get to know your audience, then you've got a far better chance of pulling it off. And I would always start straight. You know, I think I think it's sometimes a little too brave to weigh in and try to impose your sense of humor on an audience that you don't know, an audience that haven't actually paid to come and see you as a comedian or tuned in to watch you and listen to you as a football commentator. You know, this is an audience from, I don't know, the kitchens, bedrooms and bathrooms sector. Then I try to do a little bit of work on, obviously you get privy to who's going to win the awards, and I try to find out a little bit about them so that I can talk about the impact that they've made in the industry. And you do see, you know, people who are considerably more A, B or C list than I'll ever be, just taking the money and smiling and getting it all wrong. Well, yeah, good luck to you. But you're not going to get asked back to do that kind of event again. And I take communication very seriously. If somebody had offered me at the age of, I don't know, 16, 17, when I really, really wanted to work in this business, if somebody said to me, look, Clive, the bad news is you're going to become an accountant. You're not going to get to work in media. But as part of a crazy reality show, we're going to give you 30 seconds of network football commentary to 20 million people, just as a kind of consolation prize. I try to treat every 30 seconds of commentary that I do like those 30 seconds. I think once you get a platform and an ability to communicate and speak to people, you should make every second count, and you certainly should put as much thought into trying to do that as you can. I hate lazy broadcasting, lazy commentating. We are absolutely privileged to have this opportunity to do what we always wanted to do for a living. So honor that privilege and make sure that you're trying your very best to make every second count.
I couldn't agree more. And I think there's two words that come in that you obviously have in spades. It's professionalism and respect. It's and that, I think, is something that our audience can take away. So I on top of that professionalism and respect, to go, your humour really adds that extra dimension to your commentaries. And that, for me, and obviously for my son, makes it really enjoyable to listen to you. You just talked about you didn't do anything at the start of, you kept it straight at the start of corporate. Do you think that someone can actually plan humour in a commentary, or does it really have to just be natural?
Well, I think when in the course of one's research, my research is not certainly not just about facts and figures and stats. Again, it's something that Reg Guttridge gave me. He said, you're a journalist. What you are, you're a broadcast journalist. And so the important part of your job during a commentary is to editorialize as a journalist would, to ask yourself, what's the story here? And you can prepare for different eventualities. You can, you know, before a Champions League final, let's go back to the one that you mentioned at the start. In 1999, Manchester United went to the final in Barcelona, as indeed Bayern Munich did, to play for the treble. You know, both teams had already won their national titles and their domestic FA Cups. So they were playing for unique trebles. And so you can start to map out in your mind and maybe even make some sketches or some phrases on paper. You know, Manchester United win, Bayern Munich win. What does this mean? What is the editorial significance of the two results? And if something comedic occurs to you, then yeah, sure, make a note of it. If it's not cheating to try to anticipate how something's going to work out, it's scandalous to try to use the material where it doesn't fit. You know, yeah. I think that there are some of my brethren who shoved a little crawler going across the bottom of the screen, which says, I've fucking well done this research, so you're fucking well going to hear it. facts and facts. And by the way, I have a theory that every commentator should be allowed one fuck per season. Fuck is an important word in football. There are certain things which happen on a football field where the only relevant thing you can say is fuck. So we should be allowed one per season. We should use it very carefully, rather like a cricket captain uses the reviews. You can only have that one, so don't use it over something which is not. Use it when it really, really matters. I think it would improve commentary immeasurably. But there you go. You can give some thought to the different scenarios, really, and, yeah, prepare thoughts and maybe phrases and maybe even comic moments which will fit. But you can only use them when they fit, because it stands out like the proverbial sore thumb when a commentator prizes something in to a commentary which they've thought about before but doesn't belong in that moment. Commentary is all about capturing moments.
You were very friendly with John Motson. Do you think Motti had it written beforehand in 1988 that the Crazy Gang have beaten the Culture Club?
Well, what if he did? It's okay. It's fine. The Crazy Gang did beat the Culture Club. I mean, if he tried to say a minute before the end, you know, I thought the Culture Club would get over the Crazy. Yeah, exactly. He delivered it. Timing is such a massive part of great comedy. I mean, all of those wonderful sitcoms that I grew up with, where the characters were so lovingly written, so you kind of knew what they would say, how they would react to a certain situation. I mean, if John Le Mesurier was putting away Arthur Lowe, it was the pause before the put down which made that comedy gold in Dad's Army. And Dad's Army looks terribly dated now. Well, of course it's dated, because it belonged in its moment. It was brilliant in its moment. And we all get a little smile when they come up on some gold channel and we see 40 Towers all over and again. They're never quite as good today. You know, I've tried to indoctrinate my gorgeous wife in the Fast Show. It doesn't quite work anymore somehow. It doesn't feel quite as funny as it did at the time. And I'm slightly embarrassed by, you know, my fanaticism for it when I'm trying to show her a clip which I think is funny. And that is so true of sport. I mean, everybody wants to try to compare Ronaldo with Pelé. Don't. You know, Pelé played in the 60s and 70s, 50s, 60s, 70s. Cristiano Ronaldo played, you know, we're still playing now. Just accept that is in that what belongs this moment. And that what we were talking about, cancel culture and trying to rewrite novels and rewrite plays and take words out. No. Watch them in their context. I mean, if by putting them on 2023 TV is going to offend somebody, don't put it on. But have a link to Till Death Us Do Part, so people can see it as a part of the social history of this country, and you can watch it in its context. And I think that's really, really important. And Motti, at that moment, nailed it.
He certainly did. And very quickly, we've reached a part of the show, Clive, which we like to call quickfire questions. So we'll make them that.
Quickfire questions.
Who is the funniest business person that you've met? Or maybe football is your business, maybe that.
Football is my business. The raconteurs, McCoist, Martin O'Neill, Andy Townsend, they would be my perfect supper party, yeah.
Oh, perfect. What book makes you laugh, Clive?
I'm not a great reader of books. I'm more a reader of columns and articles. I love great writing. Raphael Baer is my favourite political writer of the moment. In the past, Clive James.
Oh, what a genius that man was. What film makes you laugh?
Airplane. Repeatedly. Oh. Same jokes, same laugh.
Surely you can't be serious.
Surely.
Taking a shift to the other side, I think we've already investigated this. What's not funny?
Miranda, Mrs. Brown's Boys. I don't get Fleabag, but it's not aimed at me, which comes back to your audience. I don't think Fleabag's funny, but they didn't make it for a 68-year-old man.
Exactly. What word makes you laugh?
Ni. As said in by the knights who say ni in Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
We are no longer the knights who say ni. We are now the knights who say fatang, fatang.
Icky, icky, icky. Fatang, fatang.
What sound makes you laugh?
Oh, sounds that shouldn't make me laugh. I, as I grow older, I have less control over my body. You've got to laugh.
You have to.
Sorry.
You went to Nottingham University, got a good degree. Would you rather be considered clever or funny?
I'd take either.
Take whatever you're given. I think you've got both safely in the bag, Clive. And finally, Clive, desert island gags. You can only take one joke with you to a desert island. What is it?
I don't really like jokes. I like stories. So put your safety belt on and listen to this story. I died yesterday, and to my surprise, I went to heaven. And when I arrived at the pearly gates, St. Peter was there saying, "Thank goodness you're here. We've got a big match on and we need a commentator. To be honest, it's the only reason you've got in. John Watson came quite recently, but he's far too expensive for us." I said, "Okay, if it means not a fiery inferno, I'll come with you and commentate." So he leads me up this verdant pasture to the crest of a brow, looking down on this celestial football field where the players are warming up. And I look down there and I see Paul Gascoigne, and I'm alarmed. And I say to St. Peter, "Gazza, he was much younger than me. What happened?" And he goes, "That's not Gazza, number 8. I said, "Yeah." He said, "No, that's God." I said, "Okay." And I watched him and I saw him strutting around in that rather upright running style he had and holding people off as he did, all those stepovers, and was so characteristic of Gazza. And I called St. Peter back and I said, "I'm sorry, that's Gazza. That's Paul Gascoigne." And St. Peter put his arm on my shoulder and he said, "Don't worry, it's God. He just thinks he's Paul Gascoigne."
Oh, what a brilliant story and a brilliant gag at the same time. Clive Tildesley, you've been absolutely superb. I can't believe that you said that you don't laugh at people falling over when you commentate on the Premier League, but it's absolutely been wonderful to have you as part of the Humorology podcast. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Keep smiling.
The Humorology podcast was hosted by Paul Barros, produced by David Rose, music by Steve Hayworth, creative direction by Les Hughes, and additional research by Helen Sykes. Please remember to subscribe, like, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. This has been a Big Sky production.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.